right, it's time for us to get started this evening. That seems a little loud. Does that seem a little loud to you? We are back in Nahum. We're going to wrap up chapter 1, which we didn't get through last time, and then move into chapter 2 and try to get through all of that as well. So that's what we're looking at covering. We began last time with the discussion of the first chunk of Nahum 1, which is this basically psalm of praise to God for who He is, for His character of being a righteous judge. And that's going to lead then into these basic consequences of who God is. You know, if God is this, this is what He is going to do. And in particular, as it relates to the Assyrian people, it means He's going to judge them. And so we'll look at that briefly, I hope, this evening before moving into chapter 2, which is much more detail on that same topic. This is one of those spots where you find people that will complain about a bad chapter division here. You'll find some that say it's a good chapter division. And really, the problem is that 1 and 2 really go together so well, you could make a single chapter out of the whole thing. Or subdivided up somehow into other units. That's where it just gets tough because all of this just flows so well. And so some see the unit stopping in verse 15. Some see it carrying through into verse 2 of chapter 2. But then you could also make an argument that 1 through 9 of chapter 2 is a separate unit, and that's still connecting back. And we'll look at a little bit of that here in a moment as well of how all of this interrelates with each other as we get into it here in just a moment. Let's begin, though, with a word of prayer together. Our good Father, we're so thankful to You for who You are and for all the good things that You do for us. We're thankful that we can depend on You, that You are unchanging, that who You are is who You are and who You will ever be, and that we know that You will act in a certain way because of that character. And so, Father, we ask that we would put our trust in You, and that we would live lives that would avoid the judgment that is certain and depend on You and Your grace and Your mercy for the forgiveness that we so desperately need. Be with us tonight as we study Your Word. Help us to hear what it has to say to us, that it would shape us into the people You would have us to be. In Your Son we pray. Amen. All right, so verses 12 through 15, we'll read this to get it back in our minds. I don't know how many of you read this since last Wednesday, so it's been a little while since we actually looked at this text. So beginning in verse 12, we're not going to retread all of the ground of verses 2 through 11. But beginning in verse 12, thus says the Lord, and you know, you have that thus says the Lord phrase so much in the Bible. What you don't always stop and think about is frequently that thus is a therefore sort of idea, drawing a conclusion based on something that has just been said. And this is one of those spots where it's really clear that that's what's going on the basis of what we've just said about who God is. Thus God speaks in that regard. Though they are at full strength in many, they will be cut down and pass away. Though I have afflicted you, I will afflict you no more. And now I will break His yoke from off of you, and I will burst your bonds apart. The Lord has given commandment about you. No more shall your name be perpetuated. From the house of your gods I will cut off the carved image and the metal image. I will make your grave, for you are vile. Behold, upon the mountains, the feet of Him who brings good news, who publishes peace. Keep your feasts, O Judah, fulfill your vows, for never again shall the worthless pass through you. He is utterly cut off. And so three things in particular that you might articulate as God doing as a result of His character. First, that God will liberate the afflicted. There will be nothing that will stop God from overthrowing the oppressor. And though they are full strength and many, some translations render that as having allies of some kind. There's debate as to what the Hebrew word means, and we don't need to get in all of that. But the point is, though they are many, though they have allies, though they have strength, though they have defenses, whatever it is that they could muster, it's not going to matter, is really what it amounts to as much as anything. God's going to liberate the people of Israel, the people of Judah. And just as God had previously used Assyria as His instrument of judgment, so also now how he's going to use another nation as an instrument of judgment on Assyria, and the yoke that they have on his own people is going to be broken. He's not going to afflict his own people anymore. He's going to set them free, so to speak. And this is one of those things we'll come back to in chapter 2 as well. What does it mean that God's going to set his people free with the destruction of the Assyrians, when what we know is going to happen next is Babylon's going to take control of the world and they're going to be oppressing God's people after that? We'll come back to that idea in a little bit. Verse 14, God's going to judge the oppressor specifically. The Lord has given commandment about you. No more shall your name be perpetuated from the house of your gods. I will cut off the carved image and the metal image. I will make your grave, for you are vile. So kind of going backwards there, their impending death, the destruction of their worthless gods, which itself is, in the larger biblical context, kind of a poetic justice moment, because you remember when the Assyrians had besieged Jerusalem, one of their great taunts against the people of God is, who's going to save you? Don't trust in your God. We've gone all to these other places and destroyed all their gods. They trusted in their gods and they couldn't deliver them. What makes you think your God's going to be any better than those gods who couldn't deliver those people? And well, that same thing is now happening to them. It turns out that Israel's God was the true God, who is the actual judge, and he's going to do to them what they'd done to so many other nations here in judging them and destroying them. And then the first thing that he says here, the last one that I'll mention, is back up in verse 14, no more shall your name be perpetuated. This is something that would have had an especially significant impact on the Assyrian nation. And again, we don't know if Assyria ever heard Nahum's prophecy. There's just no way of knowing that one way or the other. But the idea would have been something that would have really impacted them greatly, because they were well known for inscribing their names all over the places and writing them down in annals and including them in their, you know, sculpting and in their friezes, these big, you know, wall art, whether they're drawings or sculptures or whatever. They put their name all over everything so they wouldn't be forgotten. In fact, one of the Assyrian kings in particular put a curse in the annals on anyone who would take his name out of the annals, because they wanted their name to be known. That's what they were known as doing as much as anything. So this is apparently a very culturally specific sort of attack on them, as we'll see here at the end of chapter 2 as well. God's taking something from Assyrian culture and using it as part of their judgment. Here their name is going to be wiped out. Now this is also the kind of promise that we can't take too literally and force too literally. What does it mean their names are going to be wiped out and forgotten? Well, I could tell you about Tiglath-Pileser and Sennacherib and Sargon. I mean, I know lots of Assyrian kings by their names, and I know things about them. And so the point of this, it's kind of like Ezekiel's prophecy against the city of Tyre that says, you know, it'll be impossible to find, that it'll never be rebuilt. Well, you know, the point isn't that God struck everyone with some sort of geographical ineptitude that nobody knows where the city of Tyre used to be anymore. And we've just got it wrong. It was actually, you know, over in China. No, that's not the point. It's for it to be found refers to the glory of the city being found again. For it to rebuild doesn't mean that, you know, there's a little fishing village there where Tyre used to be. Well, it's been rebuilt. Well, technically, I suppose. But, I mean, you think about it. If someone came through and destroyed the city of Tampa entirely, and then in 2,000 years there was a 500-person village here, would you say Tampa had been rebuilt? No, not really. I mean, there may be something here that bears the name that's in the same place, but everything that this city is has not been rebuilt. And so that idea of their names being, you know, removed, it won't be perpetuated, I mean, that's the obvious thing. They're not continuing on. But even the idea of their names being, you know, no more isn't that they're going to be totally forgotten about or anything along those lines. And then finally, God is going to announce good news. And this is a really interesting verse, because this is a verse that's really familiar to you. You've heard this verse before. I know you've heard this verse before, because It's in Isaiah, which we know really well, and it's in Romans, which we know really well. We don't know Nahum as well, at least most people don't. And so as you're reading through Nahum and you come across this verse, you go, huh, what's this doing in Nahum? I'm not quite sure. The behold on the mountain, the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace. What's that doing here? Well, it's the same kind of idea that you find in Isaiah 52, where it's about restoration from Babylonian captivity. Well, now it's restoration from Assyrian captivity, and so it's the same basic idea. And in Romans, where it shows up in Romans 10, it becomes the preaching of the gospel of the Messiah, who brings liberation from sin. And the exile of sin. And so it's this same idea that we find that we've talked about in earlier classes about the day of the Lord. Well, what is the day of the Lord? Well, it depends on the context. You know, Jerusalem had their day of the Lord. Samaria had their day of the Lord. Nineveh has their day of the Lord. Babylon had their day of the Lord. So does Jerusalem again, and so does Rome. And all of that's pointing forward to the very end of time when the ultimate day of the Lord is going to happen. Well, the same thing is true here. This preaching of good news. What's it a reference to? Well, it's the good news of God overthrowing the Assyrians. It's the good news of God overthrowing the Babylonians. It's the good news of God overthrowing the devil and the messianic victory that comes with that. And so this is one of these prophecies that has multiple layers of fulfillment through the years. It's a constantly true principle, maybe another way of thinking about it. That when you meet a new context in which it applies, it still applies because the truth of this idea shows itself in a variety of different sorts of contexts. All right, any thoughts here about the end of chapter 1 before we get on into chapter 2? All right, well, chapter 2, again, it's really continuing this discussion of the destruction of the city of Nineveh. You're going to get further declarations of judgment. You're going to get a description of the battle itself, the results of the battle, and then kind of a final taunt, you might say, against the Assyrians. Just a couple things here by way of introduction that I think are worth noting, but not getting too bogged down on. First of all, there are verbal connections at the end of each section. Now, that's a sentence that, or a phrase that might not mean anything to you off the top of your head to see that. But what that means is there is a key word that shows up at the end of various sections that connects them together. So, for example, verses 2 through 15 of chapter 1, 2 through 15, ends with the idea of the worthless one being cut off. No, not cut off. The worthless one having his... No, that is right. No, that's not right. 2 through 12. 2 through 11. My notes are wrong. 1, 2 through 11, the worthless counselor. And then 12 through 15, the worthless one is completely cut off. And so those are two pretty clearly separated sections that each end with the same idea, a reference to this worthless one. And then... 12 through 15 there, the worthless one is cut off. And then at the end of chapter 2, in verse 13, there's the cutting off idea again showing up. And so all of these are interconnected with each other. And again, it's a way of indicating how all of chapters 1 and 2 flow from one section to the next to the next. And there are these segues built in that connect them all back together. Also, there are contrasts that run through chapter 2 that are worth noting here and just to kind of keep an eye out for. It begins with the strength of Assyria in verse 1. Collect all your strength, it says there. And it's going to end with the weakness of Assyria down in verse 10. Desolate, desolation and ruin. Hearts melt and knees tremble. Anguish is in all loins. All faces grow pale. So you begin with the strength, and at the end they're just terrified and trembling from all of this. Verse 2, Israel has been plundered. Plunderers have plundered them and ruined their branches. And then you get down to verse 9, plunder the silver, plunder the gold. Now we're talking about Nineveh. So Israel had been plundered. Now Nineveh is being plundered as a result of this. And then that endless wealth there in verse 9, plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end of all the treasure or of wealth of all the precious things to the desolation that happens as a result of it there in verse 10. And there's a few others of those kinds of things, but those are some of the really obvious ones. And so the point of this is whatever the situation is at the beginning of this, as it relates to Israel, as it relates to Assyria, by the end of chapter 2, it's in the exact opposite circumstance. So the judgment of God is such that it's going to reverse the way things are. Okay?
There
is some, we don't know all the details. There is reference, and if you're listening at home and didn't hear that, the question is historically, how did Nineveh fall? There is reference outside the Bible, and there seemed to be reference in Nahum as well, to waters playing a part in it. A historian outside the Bible makes reference to one of the rivers flooding and tearing down a huge chunk of the wall. And we saw that back in chapter 1 and verse 8, with an overflowing flood, he will make a complete end to the adversaries. And then you get the same idea as well in verse 6 of chapter 2, the river gates are open, the palace melts away. The Babylonians and the Medes allied together against the Assyrians. Apparently, the rivers flooded and knocked a big hole in the wall, and that let them have easy access into the city. One of the stories is the king saw that the city was falling and basically knew what awaited him, presumably based on the reputation of the Assyrians and how cruel they'd been to others and, people wanting to get their payback. And he locked locked himself and all of his harem and his eunuchs in a giant room and set a giant fire and burned them all themselves to death. So there's that as well. And so, there's a little bit that we know about the fall of Nineveh, but not a ton. But where it does intersect with the Bible, it does seem to be in alignment as far as the water is playing some part. But anything else there? Okay. All right. So let's begin with the first couple of verses here in this declaration of judgment. The scatterer has come up against you. Man the ramparts, watch the road, dress for battle, collect all your strength. For the Lord is restoring the majesty of Jacob as the majesty of Israel. For plunderers have plundered them and ruined their branches. And so it begins with this call to prepare, but you've got to realize that this is an ironic, sarcastic, satirical call to prepare. All right, everybody, man your forces up. God's coming to do battle with you. Muster up your army. And Nineveh was as strong of a city as you would have at this point in history. The reports of Sennacherib's armory is that it covered some 40 acres of land. A later king added to it after that. The royal road inside the city had been widened to allow for quick movement of troops within the city. There was a massive city wall that rose up to 60 feet in some places and a moat outside of that. And the Tigris River ran beside the city, which added another layer of protection to at least one side of it. But stop and think about it. Prepare your forces because God's coming to do war with you. That'd be a little bit like seeing a gnat on your kitchen counter and raising your fly swatter and saying to it, prepare for battle, gnat. What's the point, right? It doesn't have a chance, and nothing it could do could change the situation. And that's the tone of this call for Nineveh to prepare for war. Because, the point is that it is not Babylon and the Medes and their coalition that's doing war with Assyria, but God is. Notice in verse 13, "Behold, I am against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword shall devour your young lions. I will cut off your prey from the earth, and the voice of your messengers will be no longer heard." And so what all mustering of forces they could do is totally irrelevant in the larger scheme of things. And so that leads into verse 2, which is this reversal of fortunes verse, which is really a classic prophetic restoration kind of passage. that there's going to be hope of a future restoration of God's people, and that shows up here in this verse as well. Now, there's a couple quick notes I need to make about this. In this verse, Jacob and Israel are in parallel to one another, which means they're to be understood as the same thing. There have been some that have suggested that Israel is Israel and Jacob is a reference to Judah. So it's the two parts of the kingdom, Israel and Judah. There is nowhere else in the Bible that I'm aware of where the southern kingdom specifically is called Jacob in contrast to the northern kingdom. If that's what's going on here, it's the only place in the entire Bible that that happens. And especially in parallel like this, it usually is a reference to the same idea, not to two different ideas. So it's Jacob and Jacob, Israel and Israel. But what does that mean? And I would suggest it's probably not a reference to the northern 10 tribes, but to Israel as a whole. It's the restoration of God's people, Israel. And that is a clearer idea in biblical prophecy, that God's people are going to be restored, not one set or the other of the tribes. And in the book of Ezra, when they are coming back, there seems to be... the author seems to be at great pains to emphasize that this is a restoration of Israel. Even if not everybody is literally there, it's a calling back of the nation of Israel, a going back home of the nation of Israel, not just the southern kingdom, not just the northern kingdom. And I think that's what this is the idea of here as well. But then I think you also need to realize then that what that means is that this is not to be seen as an immediate result of the fall of Syria. It's easy to read verse 1, or really the end of chapter 1 and into verse 1, and then look at verse 2 and say, aha, once Nineveh falls, the 10 tribes are going home. Well, that's not what happens historically. And if you understand this as being fulfilled, at least partially, in the return of Zerubbabel and others, that this is not something that immediately happens then. But then you might also realize that there are other restoration passages in the prophets, like Amos 9, for example, that the New Testament picks up and applies to the church. And so again, this may be one of those ideas that has multiple layers of fulfillment depending on context, where there is a sense in which it's fulfilled in the return under Cyrus' decree, and there is a sense in which the church is a restored Israel in that sort of different context and different kind of meaning of the passage there. All right, well, verses 3 through 5 describes the attack itself. The shield of his mighty men is red, his soldiers are clothed in scarlet. The chariots come with a flashing metal on the day he musters them. The cypress spears are brandished. The chariots race madly through the streets. They rush to and fro through the squares. They gleam like torches. They dart like lightning. He remembers his officers. They stumble as they go. They hasten to the wall. The siege tower is set up. And I'll stop there for a second. Because what happens next is basically it's over. This is one of those spots where you find the beginning of the battle described, what's being set up for the battle being described, and the aftermath of the battle being described. But the actual battle itself, it's like a couple of words. And what that seems to be doing when that happens in a narrative is it's a way of indicating how thoroughly one-sided the battle is. When you have like 10 verses dedicated to the battle lines being drawn, and then another 5 verses dedicated to them running for their lives, and one verse that says, and the battle happened, that's a pretty clear way of saying this wasn't much of a battle. And that's what's going to happen here as well. Now, there's a few things in this text that are odd, and so you'll have translations that say different things along the way. So I wanted to make a few notes about that in case your translations are saying something different from what I just read. The cypress spears in verse 3 that I read, literally there it's just the cypress, or your translation may even render that a different wood word for wood, a different kind of wood, because that sort of botanical precision is not always possible. But the question is, cypress what? What is it that's being referred to? Well, this is a battle, so they're probably not cypress trees. The point is that it's some sort of wooden weaponry, and spears is what most people go with as an obvious sort of choice as to what it is. But it's some sort of weaponry there that's being referred to in verse 3. Also in verse 3, translation I'm read from says the chariots come with flashing metal. Some of your translations may say flashing torches. The difference between metal and torches in the Hebrew is two letters that are transposed with one another. So it's, you know, which one is it? It's hard to know. Well, I know you've got torches in verse 4 that seem to be the case. And either way, the point is largely the same, so it's not that big of a deal. Most modern translations go with flashing metal. The New King James is about the only modern one that doesn't. The Old King James, the Revised Standard, also say torches there as well, but it's not that big of a deal. Verse 5 is probably most difficult. Translation I'm reading from says, what did it say? The siege tower. Is set up. Some translations say defense or protective shield. The New American Standard says the mantlet, because we all use that word all the time, right? And so the question is, what's being set up here? Is it a siege tower that they're building up to the wall to get over the wall, which fits the context of ancient warfare? Or is it some sort of protective shield like a mantlet that they would set up to protect themselves from arrows and spears and rocks and hot oil and whatever else is being thrown down at them from the wall? Again, either they're protecting themselves or they're building up a siege mound. There's one translation, I don't remember which one it was, but it said the protective siege tower, and so I guess they just decided they're going to lump it all together. Again, it's not that big of a deal. This is ancient warfare, and it's being described in terms of ancient warfare. But there are some differences, and so I thought I'd at least mention that quickly. But what's really striking about it is the clear picture of a war you get. It is described in terms of sight and sound, and some of the sound is not clearly stated, but you can also hear it as it happens. You've got colorful uniforms and flashing metal and cypress spears and chariots rushing through the gates of the city and gleaming like torches. It's a very vivid picture that Nahum draws. But then also you think about clanging metal and rattling wheels and all of that as it happens. Nahum doesn't say clanging metal and rattling wheels and all of that, you know, whirring arrows or whatever else you may come up with, it still is such a striking picture that you can imagine it happening. You can see it, you can hear it as it's being described, and provides this very striking mental image, especially to people who are familiar with warfare. I mean, it's a little bit harder for us because, you know, we've been sitting on our couches for our entire lives. Maybe we've seen a documentary or something, but we've never experienced war the way these people had. This would have been a very vivid image to them of preparing for this battle that's about to happen. That again, when you get to verse 6, that's the battle, is verse 6. The river gates are open, the palace melts away. And it's over. That's it. And everything after that is the aftermath of the battle. The mistress is stripped. She's carried off. Her slave girls lamenting, moaning like doves and beating their breasts. Nineveh's like a pool whose waters run away. Halt, halt, they cry, but none turns back. Plunder the silver, plunder the gold. There is no end to the treasure or of the wealth of the precious things. And so the thorough defeat of the city of Nineveh shows up here. Again, there's no real detail given of the battle itself, just that it's a complete rout. The water washes away their defenses, and then all of a sudden people are running for their lives. The city is being plundered. People are being carried off and moaning and lamenting. And that's what happens with this overthrow. Now, the word mistress there in verse 7 is another one of those words. We don't know exactly what the meaning of it is. That happens most frequently when words show up a very few number of times in an ancient language. Most words, you can figure out what they mean when you see it used enough times, and context tells you what it means. But if you've got a word that only shows up once in the entire history of that language, It gets a little bit harder to figure out what it means. Now, sometimes the context can make it pretty clear, at least what the general idea of that word is, but even then it's hard to be specific with what exactly it means, what nuances it may have, and things like that. So we have this difficulty with Hebrew and Greek from time to time of words not having enough usage to help us understand their meaning. This word mistress, we don't know exactly what it means. It's almost certainly a reference to the city. The city is frequently referred to as a female in a variety of sorts of contexts. And here, the mistress is stripped. She is carried off. Her slave girls lamenting, who is this that's being talked about? Well, apparently it's the city of Nineveh that's being talked about. And so it seems to be a reference to the city itself and what's happening to the city as a result of the battle. But again, notice already in verse 7, they're being carried off. The battle's over. They're being hauled off into exile, which is, of course, poetic justice, because what had they done to so many other people? They exiled them. Now, they didn't carry them into captivity the way the Babylonians did. They scattered them. But again, it was a kind of exile that they were putting people into, and now it is happening to them. You've got the lamenting, the moaning like doves, the beating their breasts, all very common signs of mourning, ritualistic mourning, in particular the sorrow that is there in the city, which, again, it's pretty obvious. Their city has been destroyed. They're sorrowful, of course. But notice how emphatic it is. Lamenting, moaning, beating their breasts, this kind of repetition of the idea to make it emphatic. And that's one of the things that I think we can forget as well as we study the Bible, is the way they would emphasize things is different how we would emphasize things. If I want to emphasize a word, what I do is I make it bold. Select the word and click, you know, the bold button. And that emphasizes the word. Or if I'm really obnoxious, I'm going to make it all caps and bold and underlined and italic all at the same time. Maybe put some exclamation points around it. And you can make it really emphatic then. Well, they didn't have all of those options back then. Because Hebrew and even in first century Greek only had one case of letter, you can even capitalize it to make it emphatic. So what they would do is they would have repetitive sorts of devices to emphasize something. And sometimes it's repeating a word in two different forms. So the phrase, if you see it in the Bible, you will surely fall. In the Hebrew, it is almost always that idea of you will surely X, whatever X is a participle followed by an imperfect, a future tense. Falling, you will fall, is what it says. Almost all the time. And that's a way of emphasizing the certainty of this thing happening. Or sometimes it would just repeat the word, Abraham, Abraham. You know, but Samuel, Samuel. Repeating the name is a way of emphasizing something as well. Or if it's really important, you'd get it three times. Holy, holy, holy. And so just different sorts of ways of emphasizing. So when her slave girls are lamenting, moaning like doves, beating their breasts, three straight lines to say the same basic thing, it's a way of emphasizing how thorough the defeat and the mourning and the sadness and everything else is along those lines. And we're going to see the same thing in verse 10 with the repetition, but we'll get to that in just a second here. Just complete terror. Nineveh's like a pool whose waters run away. I don't know exactly what we're to imagine here, but the idea is uncontrolled water rushing. Nineveh is rushing out of the city like a broken down dam and the water rushing away from it, I think is the idea. I don't know how many of you have ever dealt with an above-the-ground pool that had a problem. I'm sure you've seen videos of that happening. You know, some clown tries to jump over the edge and hits the side and everything goes rushing away. That's the idea here as well. The residents of Nineveh are rushing away like water that is completely out of control here. Halt, halt, they cry, but none turns back. they don't stop to look and see what's going on behind them. I mean, they're better than Lot's wife, I guess. They're just running for their lives. They don't care about what's going on. People are saying, stop, stop, help, stop. No, they just keep on going. And that's how dedicated they are to getting away as quickly as they can, is the idea there of that image. And then, again, poetic justice, plunder the city. How is it that Nineveh had all of this wealth? There's no end to the treasure or the wealth of all the... There's no end to all of this. Well, how did they get so wealthy? Well, they got really wealthy by plundering a bunch of other cities that they destroyed. And so now the time has come for that to happen to them. And the God of justice that we met in chapter 1 is meting out that justice on this city, and they are being plundered because they had plundered so many before them. And the greatest city in the ancient world, at least up to this point, is completely fallen and abandoned and looted. And the idea, I mean, if you told someone, you know, 50 years before this, Nineveh is going to be overthrown completely. It will fall. It will be abandoned by its own people. The king is going to burn himself in a room with all of his, you know, concubines and all of his servants. And a few people are going to get away, and they're just going to be running for their lives. And it's all going to be looted and plundered. You know, that would be one of those things that'd be really a tough thing to believe. And yet, here it is now, and it is happening. That's another interesting thing about this text is, I don't know what all of your translations do with this, but in the Hebrew, it is in a verbal tense that is almost always translated as a past tense. It's the perfect tense in Hebrew. And the translation I'm reading from makes it all kind of a present tense, like it's happening, you're seeing it happen. Some will translate it as a future tense because it's a prophecy and it's going to happen in the future. It's all written in what we would call a past tense. And it's what a lot of commentators call the prophetic perfect. And what that means is it hasn't happened yet, but it's so certain that you can talk about it in the past tense as if it's already happened, because God has said it. And because God said it, you can count on it. And it's going to happen. And so, you know, you tell someone 50 years earlier this is going to happen, and no one would believe it. And yet, God can talk about it in the past tense because it is that certain that it's going to happen. All right, we got about 5 minutes left, a little bit more than. Any thoughts here before we look at the last few verses? Yeah. Yeah, I think verse 3 is separate enough from verse 2 that it's not talking about the armies of Israel. It has even been suggested, and I don't from what I understand, or from what I think, I didn't do a lot of digging into this, but from what I've gathered from the little that I looked into it, I don't think there's any textual evidence of this in any of the manuscripts, but some have suggested that verses 1 and 2 are out of order. Because verse 2 goes really well with verse 15 of chapter 1. The on the mountains, the feet of him who brings good news, who publishes peace. Keep your feasts, O Judah, fulfill your vows, for the Lord is restoring the majesty of Jacob. I mean, it just flows right into it. And then verse 1, the scatterer has come up against you, man the ramparts, watch the road, dress for battle, collect all your strength, the shield of his mighty men is red as soldiers. And those flow together really well. Now, that's true. At the same time, Old Testament writers frequently bounce back and forth between ideas and put other things in between them. So I don't think it's a very compelling that it must have been that way. But I think seeing that also makes you realize perhaps that verse 3 is further removed from verse 2 and content than it might look on the page. Also, I'm trying to remember which one it is. I think it's the Assyrian army that red was their color. It's what they wore into battle. And so the his would probably be a reference to the king or the leader of the army. I'm pretty sure it was the Assyrians that were the red, not the Babylonian-Mede coalition. I'd have to look at that again, though. But that's also kind of your clue that it's a reference to one of those in the battle itself. Thanks for asking. Yeah, Colleen? Right. Yeah, that's a good thought. We've talked about that idea. The day of the Lord is a day where God intervenes. Well, what does it mean? Well, it means God brings salvation to the righteous and judgment on the wicked. And the same God does both, and he does both at the same time. The river that destroys is the river that gives life, is perhaps a way of thinking about that sort of idea. Interestingly, that same sort of idea happens at the fall of Babylon as well, where the Persian army will divert the water of the river and then use the riverbed to get into the city itself. So these ancient cities should learn something about building next to a river. You need the water source, but it can be used against you as well. All right, finally then, in verses 10 through 13, desolation and ruin. Anyone have a translation that does something different with that there in verse 10? Desolate, desolation, and ruin. No? Yeah, Greg? Okay. That's even further away. This is a spot where all three words in the Hebrew are based on the same root. It's three forms of the same word. We just don't have a third desolation word, I think, is probably part of the problem. The other thing that it does is every word is one syllable longer than the previous one. So the first one is like the shortest form. The second one adds a syllable that's still the same sort of idea. And the third one adds another syllable that's still the same idea, but it just is a building, a progressing of idea, and a threefold repetition of the same word, again, to show just how utter the desolation and destruction is. Hearts melt, knees tremble, anguish is in all loins, all faces grow pale. Where is the lion's den, the feeding place of the young lions, where the lion and the lionesses went, where his cubs were, with none to disturb? The lion tore enough for his cubs and strangled prey for his lionesses. He filled his caves with prey, his dens with torn flesh. I'll stop there for a second. So verse 10, again, there's this repetition of word to talk about how thoroughly and utterly destroyed they are. And then also, I don't know, what we might call physiological manifestations of fear, shaking and going pale and all of those kinds of things. This is what it looks like to be truly abjectly afraid of something, which is a far cry from how Assyria saw themselves. This is like what I was talking about earlier with the names being such a point of emphasis in the Assyrian records. Well, also in the Assyrian records and their sculptures and their artwork and stuff, they depicted themselves as a lion. And the Bible, even in Isaiah chapter 5, depicts Assyria as a lion. And so the question, hey, where's the lion at? It's mockery is what it is. And, you know, in verse 12, you know, you ate all this food, you gave plenty to your cubs and the lionesses, you filled your caves with the prey. Where are you at now? And it's a taunt, is what this is, using again the language that they would have been very familiar with, that they praise themselves with, of being like this lion. And the reason for all of this in verse 13, again, joins together ideas. And we said this already with this word connection at the end of the different sections. Well, here you've had this war imagery in verses 3 through 10 and the lion imagery in verses 11 and 12. I will burn your chariots in smoke, and the sword will devour your young lions. And so mixing those metaphors together as a way of saying, again, they're totally going to be destroyed is the idea. And of course, the real point of this is it's happening not because of the strength of the Babylonians, but because God is the one who is at war against them. I am against you. You know, we said just this past Sunday when we were talking about Haggai that one of the promises you find most in the Old Testament is what is really the basis of the covenant. I will be your God, you will be my people, and I will dwell with you. And that promise that God makes over and over and over, I am with you, I am with you. And how comforting it is for God to say, I am with you. Well, you take all of that and flip it completely 180 and listen to, behold, I am against you. The most comforting thing are the words of the covenant, I am with you. And what Nineveh hears in Nahum is God saying, I am against you. And you want to talk about a life goal that we should all have, is being in the position where we hear the first phrase and not the second one. Where we have not so aligned ourselves against God that He must be against us. That our goal, of course, is to be on His side in the things we do and the decisions we make. All right, well, I'll leave it there for this evening. We'll get into chapter 3 next Wednesday.